Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Many people drop a cuss word now and then. Some feel guilty about it. But it turns out that swearing may have a bad reputation. Letting the expletives fly may not be such a terrible thing to do after all. That's the argument that Dr. Emma Byrne, the sweary scientist, makes in her book, Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language.
Well, it's a terrific paradox. So most of the things that are good for us, we kind of have to force ourselves to do. So eating healthily, taking more exercise, you know, they're not the kinds of things that necessarily come easy to most of us. But swearing is something that's both good for us and we spend a lot of time trying to not do it. Once I started to realise how much of a benefit swearing has for us, both as individuals and as a wider society, it became really strange to me, or it seemed really strange to me, to keep telling ourselves we ought not to be doing it. And In the course of researching the book, the picture emerged that one of the things that keeps swearing so powerful, that helps it have this strong effect, is the fact that it remains taboo. And once you've lost that taboo, that what used to be a swear word, for example, just doesn't have the same impact now, and it doesn't have those benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart had that famous quote about hardcore pornography. He said, "I know it when I see it." And so to riff off of that famous quote, I guess we could say that we know swearing when we hear it. But there's got to be more to it than that. How do you define a swear word?
No one's ever written down a sort of an intentional definition of swearing, as in something that is a set of checklists or characteristics that tell you for sure that something is or is not a swear word. So what constitutes swearing and what constitutes vulgarity or strong language or however it's defined varies from study to study and from time to time. But the things that they have in common are the fact that swearing is always to do with something that's taboo. It's a concept or a word or a something that you wouldn't talk about without having a really good mental model of the person that you're talking to ordinarily. So they are things that could be intensely private, like, you know, bodily functions, for example. Or there are things that are potentially to do with what used to be thought of as word magic. This is where blasphemy gets its power, or where using the names of illnesses as swear words in some languages come from. So that sense of taboo, that sense that you might make a very powerful social faux pas by using it, that's part of the swearing. And the other part of it is that we reserve that kind of language for when we want to make a particularly emotive point, either deliberately or sometimes just because other language has failed us. For example, if you're injured or frustrated or something shocking happens, that's the language that remains when all other language has basically vanished. And so those are the two characteristics that let you know if a swear word is a swear word.
And I'm guessing there are also different categories of swear words?
That's right, yeah. And different countries sort of have different categories as being more important or a broader part of their vocabulary than others. So, for example, in Japan, things to do with excrement are just not that much of a swear word, which is why you've got the poop emoji, for example.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in this country, in the United Kingdom, bodily functions are still somewhat of a taboo, and you can still use the word shit, for example, as a way of emphasizing that you're surprised or excited, or even saying more recently that something's good. You know, that's the shit. Whereas, for example, bodily functions like the copulatory one, the F word,
yes,
that's also used very, very fluidly in the UK. Whereas when you try to translate, for example, a film like Pulp Fiction into Spanish, there's some brilliant papers out of translation journals saying that you can't just keep translating the word fuck as fuck in Spanish, because that's not the way it's used over there.
You talk about two different kinds of swearing, propositional swearing and non-propositional swearing. What are they?
Yeah, so this is one of the very good definitions that comes out of the scientific research, and it comes out of linguistics in general, and this idea that we have different forms of language, some of which is sort of rote or that comes out in particular situations, and we haven't really given it much conscious thought. That's the non-propositional part of language. Usually it's something that comes out when we are just not really thinking about what we're saying. Propositional swearing, on the other hand, is the stuff that you might not be picking your words particularly consciously, but they are being used to make a deliberate effect that you could go back and say why you chose that word. So propositional swearing, for example, is sometimes used what's called instrumentally as a means of making a point, of showing that you are particularly serious about a point or particularly angry or frustrated, for example.
You say that one of the benefits of swearing is that it can help us fit in at work. How?
Yeah, so this research, perhaps unsurprisingly, comes more out of the UK, Australia and New Zealand than it does out of North America. But there's something called jocular abuse. And within that, there's an awful lot of swearing. And this is a way of showing a kind of anti-authoritarian stance and a way of saying, you know, I'm not buttoned up. I'm not one of those people who's all taking myself far too seriously. And this kind of jocular abuse as well, it demonstrates that you have a very strong theory of mind about the person that you're insulting or that you're swearing at. And what you're saying is that I know that swearing is highly emotive. I know that if you didn't trust me, if you weren't my friend, that you would probably consider what I'm about to say incredibly offensive. But I'm trusting that you trust me enough that you know I'm joking. And the stronger the insult or the stronger the swear word is, that is used, the more likely it is that those people would actually describe themselves as very close friends. And with our less close friends, we use milder swearing or no swearing at all.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I would imagine that a lot of that is dependent on how people at your workplace feel about swearing. For example, my guess is that the people who work in standards and practices at the major TV networks would frown upon swearing, since that's part of their job, to make sure, you know, the major naughty words don't end up on the air. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all the standards and practices people swear like sailors in Quentin Tarantino movies. What do you think?
One of the things I've noticed is that talking to particularly production staff on radio and on-air talent like yourself is that there is that almost a kind of a pent-up feeling of I have to go through my professional life not swearing. And then the minute that the red light goes off, we're not recording anymore, that quite often people will then come out and swear a lot. And it's almost like that effort of saying, you know, everyone else is allowed to use this language and I'm not, and it's a little unfair, can sometimes lead to a bit of an outpouring, particularly at the end of an interview. But it is so varied, as you say, depending on the setting.
Sure. You say that another good thing about swearing is that it has helped to develop neuroscience. How the hell did it do that?
One of the ways that we know that swearing is very different to the rest of language is because of what happens when you have a stroke. If you have a stroke on the that affects the left side of the brain, it's very likely to impact some of the centres that are incredibly important in producing or understanding language. So there's a whole constellation of different areas that have been mapped out in the left side of the brain that help you, you know, create the muscle movements that they allow you to speak, or that allow you to turn your ideas into words. And all of those parts of the brain can be very easily damaged or disrupted by a stroke. And in fact, some people who have very severe brain injuries or brain pathologies end up losing the entire left hemisphere. You know, sometimes the entire of the left side of the brain is surgically removed. And in those people, one would expect that they would end up with no language whatsoever. Once that hemisphere's been removed, you tend to find that they can still swear. In fact, not only can they still swear, they do still swear, and they use it in a way that is emotionally and situationally appropriate. And over the years, studying people with different types of brain injuries to different areas has revealed numerous things. Like, for example, that swearing, the language that we use to do with swearing, is basically has a kind of distributed architecture. It's not just in the left side of the brain where most of our propositional language is. It's also in the right side where a lot of the emotional processing goes on. And in fact, if you have a stroke that affects the right-hand side of the brain, two things generally happen. One is that you completely lose your sense of humour. Your ability to complete a joke or spot a punchline goes totally out the window. But also, both the desire to swear and also the recognition of where swearing might be appropriate also goes out the window. And it's that inability to model what the emotional state of someone else might be seems to rob us of that understanding of swearing.
The one time when it seems that we can't help but swear is when we experience pain. For example, when we hit our thumb with a hammer, it's almost impossible not to let the expletives fly. And it seems that it does help reduce the pain. Is there any research that's been done to find out whether or not swearing does help us deal with pain?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the first studies that really got me into this area in the first place. I used to work out of the Science Museum in London. Oh. And when we have people come in of an evening, we like to run experiments that they can participate in. So they have to be pretty straightforward. And there's a chap called Dr. Richard Stevens, who's up at the University of Keele here in the UK. And he came up with this really elegant and simple experiment for looking at this. And all you need is a bucket of ice water and a stopwatch. And there's a couple of other controls involved, like making sure that people pick a swear word that is as easy to remember as the neutral word that they choose. But once they have a pair of words that they're prepared to use, you have them plunge their hands in ice water. And in one condition, they'll do the neutral word. In one condition, they'll say the swear word. And consistently, people who are swearing can keep their hands in ice water for about half as long again. Hmm. And not only that, when you interview them afterwards, they tend to rate the water as feeling less cold when their hand is in the ice water. And you can also measure physiological effects, like, for example, their heart rate going up or their palms getting quite sweaty. And so it's probably something to do, again, with that emotional centre of the brain and the fact that swearing is somehow basically recruiting those emotions as a way of helping us be more resilient. And so the same team has followed that up, looking at things like whether or not aggressive video games can help you withstand pain more, which they can. Huh. And also whether or not swearing helps you be more, you know, be more powerful in the gym. So using one of those hand exercises where you squeeze a heavy spring, people can do that for much stronger and much longer when they're swearing than when they're not.
Another kind of pain that is part of the human condition is social pain, loneliness, and things like that. Does swearing help us deal with social pain?
Yeah, and that was one of the most fascinating sets of studies that I came across while I was looking at the book. So one of the reasons we know that social pain is as sort of neurologically real as physical pain is that you can reduce the intensity of social pain by administering, you know, acetaminophen or cannabis, for example. Mm-hmm. We also know that there's an interaction that if you give somebody a mild pain and then subject them to a clinically controlled amount of pain, they will say it's much, much worse than if they previously experienced a severe pain. So, for example, there is a terrifically cruel study in which the experimental manipulation was whether or not people were left out of a virtual game of catch or whether or not they were told that their psychological profile meant that they were completely unlovable and were going to die alone. Which is the cruelest thing I've ever seen. And this includes experiments where they're making people put their hands on hot light bulbs. And so when you've had that severe social pain, physical pain just doesn't feel as strong. But given that neurologically, social and physical pain is using exactly the same pathways in the brain, swearing also helps deal with those social pains, that feeling of, you know, sort of shame or embarrassment or exclusion.
Well, what's next for swearing?
I am slightly concerned. I see that particularly here in the UK and potentially also in North America, that the words that are slurs seem to be coming back into discourse as essentially a means of throwing out a negative emotion. And they have been used in a kind of reclaimed usage sense for quite a while. So if you belong to certain communities, like in the Black community, using the N-word is a sign of solidarity often. In the LGBTQ community, the word queer was reclaimed. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing, as we have this increasingly polarized debate, particularly in things like politics, that slurs are ways of shutting people down or of dismissing people as being less important than the current speaker. And that really concerns me because I like the bodily function swearing. Mm-hmm. And I see it losing its impact. But when you use a slur, you're talking about things that divide us. So I don't know where we go next. I'd like to see us invent a whole new set of curses that's to do with technology. You know, so may your Wi-Fi password be constantly misspelt, or you know, may your Uber constantly go to the wrong address. I don't know. Yeah. Some kind of new curses for the 21st century, because I really don't don't want to see that kind of divisive language becoming the general purpose swearing.
Mm-hmm. One scenario that I can imagine is that after everyone reads your book, they'll be more likely to swear a lot more. They'll feel liberated. And assuming that this does indeed happen, this could mean that swearing could become more socially acceptable.
It's one of the things that I'm slightly concerned about. Mm. So assuming people make it as far as the conclusion, I do say that it's not really intended as a carte blanche to go out and swear as much as possible. I mean, swearing is good for you in the way that, you know, a high fiber diet is good for you, running is good for you. You know, you don't want it to be the only thing you ever do. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of its impact and a lot of its strength comes from its very special position in our language. And so what I really want people to do is listen more when they hear swearing and not just immediately respond with that kind of visceral, emotional, you know, you said a bad word and now I don't want to listen to you anymore.
Yeah.
But also to realize that when they are moved to swear, that there's something really important going on in their own psychology, their own physiology, and to understand better what it is that they might be feeling or they might be trying to achieve with that swearing. So for myself, I realized how much I used swearing as kind of a positive signal to my male colleagues that I'm one of the blokes and to be taken seriously. And since I realized that that's what I was doing, I've tried to find other ways of appearing more credible. But it took that signal. It took me recognizing this desire to say, you will f-ing listen to me. that I realized that actually this is when I feel that desire, it's usually because I realize that I'm being spoken over or I've made a point in a meeting that someone else has made and it's only been picked up when someone with a beard has said it, for example.
Yeah.
And I realize then that swearing is just one of the ways that I can alter my behavior. So it's an excellent signal for me that I need to do something different, but I don't then necessarily have to use the word. So it's a really useful part of our language, but it's only useful in that we can choose to use it or not, or that it's available when we have those moments of real extremis. Otherwise, if it just becomes diluted to the point where it's almost mandatory to swear, it will lose its effectiveness.
Dr. Emma Byrne, the sweary scientist, is the author of Swearing is Good for You: The Amazing Science of Bad Language. You can find out more about Emma at wpr.org/beta. And you can let us know your comments and questions by sending a note to beta@wpr.org. I thought about saying that you shouldn't use any dirty words in your emails to us, but after talking to Emma, I'm not sure if that would be appropriate or not. What do you think?
The thunder became this kind of symbol of the city's spirit, and people would gather in the arena to cheer them on, and they were really cheering on Oklahoma City.
Sam Anderson takes us on a tour of Oklahoma City. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.